We have an hour, and it was made very clear to me from the beginning that we have an hour, and that's it. So, we're going to move. I have two goals for today, not in any particular order. Goal number one is to fit this into an hour. Goal number two is to make this as practical and useful to you as I possibly can, which means that I'm going to do two things. Number one, interrupt me along the way if you have particular questions. I reserve the right to ask you to hold on or to say we'll get to it. But if you don't ask me questions, then I don't know that I'm making it work for you. So I may ask you to hold off, but please ask questions along the way. Number one. Number two, I'm going to quickly now outline how we're going to do this today, so that you're sort of prepared and see how it's going to work. What I will do is give you a 3-minute background so that you know who I am and where I'm coming from. We're then going to look at, as you can see in this packet, we're going to really do two things. We're going to first look at if our job today is to understand how to communicate better with our teens, then we need to understand what a teenager is psychologically. The reason that's important, the analogy I like to use is a race car driver. Anybody can get into a car and drive a car. Basically, you can figure out where the gas pedal is and you can drive. They say that race car drivers become one with their car. Race car drivers know how to get their car to respond, know how to get the best mileage out of their car. They don't want to stop for gas along the way. They know how to get it to turn, how to move on the road. The reason that they know how to do that is because they really understand their car. Our teens are our cars in this case. And we need to really understand how a teenager works in order to best be able to make them responsive. The next piece is to look at ourselves as parents. We're going to look very briefly at different types of parenting, and we're going to focus on one in particular, because what the research has shown is that one particular type of parenting has the effect of making our teens most responsive to us. So we're going to look briefly at a number of different types of parenting styles, and we're going to focus on one of them. Where I want to end is in two parts, and this is where sort of we'll see how time works. I brought three scenarios that you don't have yet with you. What I've seen in my practice as sort of typical scenarios that involve teenagers. We'll see how many we get to, because I would also like by the end to ask you for some of your questions. Typical scenarios, things that you've seen that you get into with your teens, and if we can again apply it to your particular experience, then all the better. So let's go back very briefly. If you see on any of the handouts or whatever, I'm Dr. Alex Bailey, PsyD. PsyD is a relatively, in the educational field, a new degree. It's about 20, 25 years old. And it arose because clinical psychologists were saying, you know what, we're getting a PhD. PhD is very research and statistics oriented. And many of us aren't interested in doing research and working on statistics. We pay people to do that. What we're interested in doing is learning how to work with the kids or adults. And so the PsyD is a doctor of psychology. And the training evolved into a much more practical, in the moment, interactive training. So the degree that I have is as a child clinical and school psychologist, and my training was very practical training, both in school psychology. So I have background in learning disabilities, assessments of learning disabilities, and how to remediate or work with kids with learning disabilities. And then the other piece of my training was in the clinical work, working with children and adolescents. What I sort of took from that is a real interest in adolescents in particular. And then I did my own work studying further and looking at families and parenting, the particular interests of mine. And my practice does sort of, I work with both of those. I work a lot with adolescents, with middle and high school students, and we'll define adolescents in a moment. And then I really try to work a lot with parents and parenting. That's me. If those of you who have the packets, if we look at the first page, the title there is What is a Teenager? And that's where we're going to start. We need to understand what a teenager is. Now, adolescence, or teenager-dom, as I call it, sort of has a real range. And as we see it, as we're going to look at the different styles that define a teenager, we're going to start, really, I'm going to talk about anybody from 5th, 6th grade. You're talking about 11, 12-year-olds, 10, 11, 12, mostly 11, 12, all the way up to really adolescent thinking. Some of you who have 20-year-old children are going to see it in your 20-year-old children as well. So it really sort of spans a long range. Each different sort of, there's groupings at the younger age range and at the upper age range that sort of have different characteristics, but we're going to look at sort of the general characteristics of adolescence. So let's take a look and look at their thinking style first. What we find is one of the major transitions into adolescence is the ability to think abstractly. Younger children can't really plan ahead. Don't really, for the most part, and I'm talking in general, can't understand something that's not in front of them. They need to see something and then they can talk about it. But to talk about something later or that hasn't happened yet or to make hypotheses, they can't do. And adolescents can. They begin to be able to talk in the hypothetical. What happens if? And that's going to be crucial to what we're going to be talking about. They form their own opinions, sort of connected to that. Younger children, their opinions or their parents' opinions are their opinions. You have much easier to convince a young child that you're right than to convince a teenager just because you said it. The teenagers are starting to think independently and make their own opinions, and they're starting to think critically. I don't like that opinion because, and they can really sort of talk that out. Black and white thinking is a very interesting piece of adolescence because younger, it's characteristics of the younger children. There is no shades of gray for younger children. It's right or it's wrong. It's very difficult for younger children to sort of say, well, it's right in some situations, but there are mediating variables that might change things. Adolescents start to break out of that, and we start to see them be able to sort of think in a more broad perspective, but we'll be surprised every once in a while when all of a sudden they'll come up with, well, no, that's not right. And it's not right because I learned this, or my teacher said this, or my friends are doing this, so therefore I must be able to do this. And it sort of reverts back to this black and white thinking that we saw with our young children and often throws us as parents. So there's this sort of regression every once in a while. The last piece that I call thinking is they think more highly of their peers and of their family. And that is a very general principle, but it comes out for a very specific reason. They're looking for identity, which we're going to talk about. Teenagers trying to figure out who they are. And it's natural to look to people that are more like you than people that are different than you to try to define who you are. We all do it. We look as adults. We identify sort of social psychology as a whole area that focuses on sort of who do we identify with? And it finds that we identify not with people that are different, but with people that are similar, which actually makes it difficult to expand our horizons sometimes because we're sort of staying within this closed circle. Well, teenagers do it really bad. And what they find is that, therefore, they're going to be with their peers. And their peers, as we, you know, sort of the cliche, is they're looking to their peers and they're going to value what their peers say. That's how they think. If I'm going too quickly, feel free to throw up your hand and slow me down. But I think that this is sort of, that's why I sort of outlined it this way, so we can sort of work through it. We're going to leave sort of their cognitive thinking style, how their brain works, and we're going to look into a little bit of what makes their personality, what makes a teenager who they are. As I talked about a moment ago, we have this stage of identity versus role confusion. This is the adolescent. The adolescent is trying to figure out, who are we? Who am I? What do I value? What do I like? What don't I like? What's an appropriate behavior? What's not an appropriate behavior? And ideally, at this point, they're starting to assimilate what they saw growing up in their homes with the things that they're seeing around them, with what they're seeing around them at school, and trying to figure out, what are the parts of this that I like? Parts of this that work for me? Did I do something wrong? Okay. And this is this sort of identity. They're trying to figure out who they are. And depending on how they progress through this stage in adolescence, deal with them, they're going to either do a better job at figuring out their own identity. If they can't really figure out who they are and come to a conclusion, then they start really becoming very erratic. And we see teenagers who in some situations will do this but can't be counted on it because in another situation they might do something else. Along the road here, they're establishing a set of beliefs and personal philosophy. Again, what do I believe is correct? What's right? Who is God? They ask their teachers. Some of them will ask their parents. Why does God do this? Why do good things happen to bad people and bad things happen to good people? That's all part of establishing their set of beliefs. They define themselves by looking for similarities in others, and you can see the crossover here between their personality and the development of their personality and their thinking style. If they're looking for people that are similar to them, then those people are going to then affect how they develop themselves as people. And then they come up with a little bit of an identity, a personal identity. And in adolescence, we see it more towards the later adolescence than the earlier adolescence, we start seeing them develop as either leaders, followers, introverts or extroverts. Are they people that get out there and say on the basketball court and like organize the team around them? Are they the kid that sort of lasts to be picked? And they sort of follow along with whatever everybody else is doing. Are they out there with lots of friends? Do they call friends to go out on the weekends to go over to people's houses? Or do they wait till somebody calls them, and then when nobody calls them, they just sort of stay in their room? So the introverts, right? This all develops along with their personality through adolescence. Doesn't mean you don't see some of this when they're younger, but it becomes solidified in adolescence, which is why what we do with them in adolescence becomes so important. The last piece is their moral style. What is defined as right and wrong? And as I said, when they're young, right and wrong is what they're, is whether they get punished or not. What their parents say is right or wrong. That's the definition. There's no questions. If I get punished for something, it must have been the wrong thing to do. If I get rewarded for it, it must have been the right thing to do. Unfortunately, a kid who cheats and gets an A just got rewarded for cheating. So cheating became okay to do. And they don't really internalize the wrong thing. So here what happens with moral style is right again. We're connecting it all the way back. We're going to really bring these three together. What is right is defined by what my peers say is good. If I do something, everybody laughs. In order to now formulate and really they see as a set of rules. Unfortunately, those rules have to make sense to them. Unfortunately or fortunately. Depends how you look at it. If it makes sense, then you're in great shape. If it doesn't make sense to them, then they're going to start. Friends and peers, I think that that sort of becomes obvious based on what we're saying. Justice and fairness. They are the fighters and the protectors of justice and fairness, adolescents. You hear that's not fair a lot with the teenagers. And it's not only about them. If some kid gets treated unfairly by the teacher, they'll jump in and stand up for them, which can be a wonderful value for a child, for a teenager. The problem is that they're being very aware of what's right and just, and now it's on you as parents to be able to show them that something is just and right. Because if you don't, they're going to have a lot more trouble with it. So we're starting to look, and this moral style is what's really, this last piece that we're doing is what's really going to influence how we are as parents in the rest of this talk. So we're looking at them, law and order becomes important, justice and fairness becomes important, their friends are important to them, and they're very concerned with privileges and responsibilities. Remember, their identity, they want to become who they are. Well, if I get to have a number of responsibilities and privileges that are mine, then that makes me feel better about myself and I become an able person. I become someone who's capable. If I don't have a lot of privileges or responsibilities, then I don't value myself very highly because nobody else seems to be valuing me highly. This is sort of what, this defines the teenager, which leads us to the bottom half of the page, which is what are the adolescent needs? If this is sort of what an adolescent is, then what do they need? And how do we figure out what their needs are? And the research into the moral thinking, a lot of the research that I'm talking about, that I'm bringing up on page one here, was sort of pioneered by a man named Lawrence Kohlberg. And Lawrence Kohlberg looked at cognitive development, at the stages that kids go through and their abilities to think, and said, you know what, their moral reasoning, the way they figure out what's right and wrong, parallels this in a number of ways. And as they begin to think more sophisticated ways, they're also able to reason in more sophisticated ways. And this is a lot of based on Lawrence Kohlberg, and then it was taken on by a number of his students. We're going to look quickly at these five adolescent needs. Number one says communication. You need as parents to be able to communicate with your adolescent. The idea of coming in, giving them the rules, and walking out of the room doesn't work as well as it did with younger children. And the reasons then go back to what we're talking about, right? They need to understand. They're able to reason now. They're able to hypothesize now. If they're able to sort of think things through critically, then you're throwing down a rule to them isn't going to work the same way it did when they were younger. So you have to be ready to talk to them, to engage in a dialogue. Number two, respect. Now, in talking about respect, we want to be very specific. It isn't about acting respectfully. In other words, we have a right to expect our children to treat us with respect, because that's, it says it in the Torah. It's a value of ours. And it's actually not just a Jewish value. It's an American cultural value. Children treat the elders in their society with respect. The nuance here, the difference, is how they feel about you, which is, do they feel respect for you? And that only comes for adolescents when they feel respected by you. So adolescents no longer is it just, well, I have to treat the person with respect, but it's, how do I feel about the adult in my life? How do I feel about my parents? And that only comes about, the respect, the genuine respect for you and your values, which makes you more effective as parents, comes along when they feel respected too. And we're going to see how that fits into setting rules. Empowerment. You want these kids to feel empowered. You want teenagers to start to feel like they have an effect on the world, like they are able to have some power. Now, you don't want them to have absolute power, and that's going to be your limit. Your limit setting is going to be crucial here. But they have a need to feel like they can influence the world, because that's where identity comes from. If I feel like I am powerless in this world, then I'm just going to sort of curl up in a ball in my room. And I'm going to then start to push in certain areas where I feel I can to show my power. One theory of eating disorders comes from a need for power. This is one area where I can show my power, and it comes from kids who don't feel power in other areas. So empowerment is crucial. The other piece here, number four, is encouragement, and they sort of go along together. They need to be encouraged. Teenagers need to feel like you're encouraging them to get out there and to do something, to be a part of the process. Again, it feeds into the question of empowerment and the question of how open they are to listening to you and to respecting you. If you can give them a sense of encouragement, you're actually encouraging them to do something, then you're going to get a lot better response. Why? Because if you think about it, any time that we're involved in a process, that we are encouraged and empowered to be involved in the process, then we buy into that process. When something is handed down to us and fed to us and we have no input, very often we're going to sort of shy away, or we're going to object to it. I didn't ask for it. Why should I go along with it? If you can get them to buy in, to develop it with you, if we as adults are allowed to develop what it is, the process that we're going to be involved in, then we're going to buy into it more. You see it with students at school all the time. My experience is also in the middle school and the high school as a school psychologist. And what we see is student council and student government is a fabulous example of the power of encouragement and empowerment. When you come to these students and you say, all right, guys, we need you as a student council to develop a rule for dress code, or we need to have this tzedakah drive, but we need you to develop it. Well, as these kids start to develop it and come up with it, and they're empowered to develop it, and then they bring it to their students, they're buying into it a lot better than if you came and said, all right, here's the tzedakah drive. Here's what we're doing. Here's your job. And we're going to do it. So the encouragement and empowerment here is crucial. The last piece is modeling. They're looking for models, right? We talked about it up till now. They're looking for someone to identify with. And yes, they're looking for someone who's more similar to them, which is going to lead them to their peers very often. But it doesn't absolve us of our requirement as parents. We need to always be acting in a way that we think is modeling good behavior, and modeling what we're asking of our kids. Because it tunes into the respect issue. If they feel we're modeling something valid, just give me one sec. Can't hear me. Okay, you got it. If they feel that we are being consistent in modeling what we're asking of them, then okay, there's some consistency here, and they can go into that. They can buy into it. But if we're doing one thing, obviously, and we're asking them to do something else, then they're gonna reject it. So we have these needs: communication, respect, empowerment, encouragement, and modeling. And what I want to do now we very briefly identified our teenager, right? This is how they think. This is what they're valuing. These are the needs. We're going to flip the page, and we're going to look at parenting styles. Now we need to look at ourselves a little bit. Diana Baumrind. No, there aren't. I'm sorry. Please. In 1967, you can see at the top, and then she revised it in the 90s, looked at essentially two variables that make up parenting. How demanding you are as a parent, and how responsive you are as a parent. And based on this matrix, for those of you that don't have the sheet, I'll sort of draw it out here as best I can. If we have demandingness here on the vertical, and we have responsiveness here, then we're going to end up with, depending on how responsive and how demanding you are, we're going to end up with four different types of parenting styles. And this is where you can look here on your chart. Anybody who is, and we're going to focus on the authoritative, but I want to brush through all of them. If you're low demand, but high in the responsive, so we're going to say this is the plus and this is the minus, and this is, it's a little counterintuitive, but we're going to go with it anyway. If we're going to say that you're highly responsive to your kids, you're listening to them, you listen to their needs, but you're not very demanding of them, then she called that indulgent. You're being indulgent to your child. You're not making them do a lot of stuff, but you're going to listen to them. The flip side of that is if you don't have a lot of demands, but you also don't listen to your child, then we have that uninvolved parent. Now, each of these, and I don't have it written here, but each of these parenting styles, the research then looks at how the children develop, as what their personalities are like, and how do they behave in school, in the world, at home, and it looks at that, and there's correlations that they've developed. Now, the two big ones that I want to really focus on, someone who's very demanding of their child, but not responsive. So you've got high demands for your kids, but you don't listen to them and hear them and listen to their needs. That we call the authoritarian. It's the parent who says, listen, these are the rules of the house, and we're not talking about them anymore. This is what's going to happen, and you must do them, and there's no discussion. You're very demanding, but you're not particularly responsive to what their needs are. The most influential parent, the one who can have not only get the most response from their kids, but also develops a really thoughtful and competent child, is what we call the authoritative. And the authoritative parent is one who is both demanding, you must do these things, but is also responsive. But you don't like doing it? Well, tell me why. Let's talk about it. Let's work it out. And as we look through this, we're going to see very quickly why that becomes the most effective. It's going to become very self-evident. So some of you are going to be identifying yourself now along these four quadrants. Yes? Both. Absolutely both. Because we're talking about, when you're trying to parent your teen, you're trying to teach them a number of different things. You're trying to teach them what are the values that we hold in this household, what makes a good person, what makes you a mensch. But also, along with that, because I see it really tied together, is the issue of, therefore, we have certain requirements when you're at home. There are certain ways that you interact with me. There are certain responsibilities that you have. And that shows and that works together in terms of what I'm trying to formulate as a good teenager. So, very quickly, for those of you that have the sheet, the uninvolved parent we talked about, the indulgent parent is more responsive than they are demanding. They're often non-traditional. They don't necessarily require mature behavior, okay? Because they're not very demanding. If my child wants to have a third ice cream cone and, you know, hasn't eaten dinner yet, it's okay. They're going to be happy. I want my child to be happy. So I'm going to do whatever I need to do. Or my child, you know, is in the supermarket when they're younger and wants that candy as we try to get out of the supermarket. The kid wants the candy. Why not? So I'm going to give them the candy again. They're going to be happy. They want to stay up. There's that great television show on. Say it again. There's a time and a place. I'm not trying to be global here. No, it's not that children should not have candy. I'm all for giving my kids candy. It works. But you have to be able to say, this is not the time. Or, you know, the classic, if you eat your broccoli, you can have the dessert, right? There's a time and a place, and it's trying to figure that out. Yes? So you're not training them for being out in the real world. because you may not, the teacher's going to say, you got to have this homework in tomorrow. And they're, no, but there's a show on, and I really want to watch this, and then I want to go to sleep late, and, you know, and the teacher's going to say, I don't care. And you're going to say, no, but the kid really wanted to watch that show. And it was a really good show. Yes. Yes, please. I'm getting tangled up. Good. And that's what we're going to get to. That really, this going back and forth and sometimes and listening to them. But there's a difference. These are general parenting styles. This is, these four quadrants define how a parent interacts with their teen most of the time. What you're going to see with the authoritative parent is that they sort of take from all of this. Because there are you listen to your child, you hear your child, you reason with your child, and we're going to get there, okay? Authoritarian parents, we talked about. Those are the highly demanding. Obedience is expected without explanation. Doesn't mean that there aren't times where we say, you're doing this. For a child's safety, you're going to tell them, you may not cross the street without holding my hand when they're younger. For a teenager, you're going to say, you may not drive at midnight. You can't go out and drive at midnight with seven friends in the car. I'm not going to let you do that. So there are times when we absolutely lay down the law. The question is, can we lay down the law with an explanation? And that's what we're going to get to with the authoritative. So let's look at the authoritative parents. There are 5 points with authoritative parenting. Number one, they are both demanding and responsive, and we saw that. What does that mean? Number two, they monitor and impart clear standards for their children's conduct. Now, for those of you with the handouts, I want you to look back at the previous page. Imparting clear standards feeds right into some of our adolescent needs at the bottom of the page. It feeds into the modeling. They're looking for someone to model for them. But we're also communicating because we're imparting to them what the standards are. And we're being very clear about it. So we're modeling and we're communicating. Next bullet, they're assertive. The parents are assertive, right? They're demanding. But they're not intrusive and restrictive. Again, if we look back at our previous page, that keys into that need for respect. You're not intruding into my space. You're giving me demands. You're letting me know what's important. And we're going to talk about how we do that in a moment. But you're not intruding. You're not always in my face, the kids say. Okay. So what happens is, with authoritative parents, is they have their demands. It's important that my child does their homework before they watch TV. It's important that my child doesn't go on the computer and play their game until they're done with whatever it is they have to do. However, I am not necessarily going to stand over them when they are on the computer and make sure every minute that they're not, playing their big brother's game instead of their game. Doesn't mean I'm not monitoring. I don't want anybody to think I'm not monitoring as a parent what my kid is doing on the computer. Or you set up a monitoring system, because today the internet is one of the scariest places to be. You're going to set up, there are standards. You may not go on these websites or these websites, but you aren't going to necessarily stand behind them all the time. You're going to check in other ways clearly with them to monitor it. So there's a trust piece, exactly, and that's where some of the respect comes from. We're going to talk some more about this because this is the key. They want their children to be assertive as well as socially responsible. That assertiveness is, again, going back to our previous page, is empowerment. You want them to be assertive and you're encouraging them. So this authoritative parent is feeding into, it feeds right into those adolescent needs. And that's why they have found in the research that the authoritative parents have the most socially responsible children, ultimately, and have the most compliant children, but not necessarily robotic children. They have thinking kids. I'm going to talk about now how that works. Yes, you have a question.
What if you've done all this stuff, and it sounds like this is the right way to go, and your kid has friends who try to pull things on their parents, and you see they get away with it.
Welcome to real life, right? Good. That's where we're going to sort of break out of the wonderful world of laboratory research and go into the real world. Why don't we do this? I'll take a couple questions and let that sort of guide where I'm going to go. Yes? Good. So the question is, within this, how do we deal with different personalities? I have 3, 4 children, 5 children, and each of them is a different child. They respond differently. They think differently. They have different temperaments. How do I deal with that? Yes, in back.
What about just a boy in Cuba who has an authoritarian style?
And very often they do. Okay. So how do we work with our kids? First of all, we know that children spend more of their waking hours in school than at home. They are often more influenced by their teachers and their rebbeim than they are by us as parents, because that's where they spend so much of their time. And how do we sort of reconcile what we're doing at home with what's happening at school? Okay, last question over there. Yeah. Correct. Oh, no. No. In fact, the question was, if we're covering this age range of 12 to 20, more or less, do I expect them to have their identities cemented by the time they're 20? And I said no, because many of us don't have our identities cemented. In fact, Carl Jung, the psychologist, Freud's student, who then sort of left, he didn't agree with Freud that much, said that we spend our life developing our sense of self with a capital S. Our goal in life is to figure out who we are. And that takes a lifetime. He was a proponent of therapy not for crisis. He said you get into therapy because it's just so what it is here now. I think it's 18 you're on your own, I think. 17? Okay. 17, 18, somewhere around. So this works. We're going to just suspend reality and go with it. Your 17-year-old just gotten his driver's license and wants to go out for pizza with some friends on Motzei Shabbos. You have two concerns. Concern number one is, will he drive safely and responsibly with his friends? Valid concern. Number two, he needs to be up for shul tomorrow morning, and you want to figure out a curfew and make sure that he's going to stick to this curfew. How do you resolve these issues? Now, let's go back to what the points were. Okay? The best scenario I came up with, I had a dog when I was younger. I came up with bark O. Bark, B is the behavior. What's your target behavior? A is, are you in agreement? This we didn't talk about. You and your spouse must be in agreement to your child before you present this to them. Doesn't mean that you guys to each other have to really believe that this is the most important value, or that this is the rule that you both would agree with. But what you present to your child is that the two of you have come to an agreement here. Because as I heard coming in from the last speaker, it's all about splitting. A kid, like sharks, can smell a drop of blood. Teenagers know it as soon as there's a little bit of a disagreement. So it doesn't mean that you and your spouse must be in agreement on everything, but you must have agreed that this is what the rule is going to be to your child. So B is behavior. A is agreement. RC is rational consequence. What's your rational consequence to the behavior if it's not agreed to, or it's not followed? And then my little O at the end is the oh no part. In discussing this ahead of time, in figuring out ahead of time, you have to sort of play in your mind, what's my adolescent going to come at me with? What about if this and this happens? What if I'm driving? I know I'm not allowed to have two people, but this kid's standing, he doesn't have anybody to take him home. I want to take him home. So you got to start thinking about that. So it's the behavior, agreement, rational consequence, and looking through the oh no's. Okay? So here how we do it. What's your first step? The first step is the behavior. I think we know the behavior. It's set down in the scenario, right? We want them to be safe, and we want them to come back on time. We know the behavior. And let's assume that the husband and wife have agreed ahead of time, yes, this is what we want. What's missing? What's the piece? What's the one specific about the curfew that we have to be in agreement on? What time? Some parents are going to say, look, your kid can come back at 12, it's fine, it's the weekend. Someone's going to say, I know that when I get him up every morning for school, he's a mess at 7 and he's gone to sleep at 10, so I'm not going to let him come back at midnight because he'll never get up for school the next morning. So you have to have worked that out. Then the rational consequence. What are some rational, let's think about it. You want your child to not have more than the two people in the car, and you want them to be back at 11 o'clock at night. What would be a rational consequence that you could present to your child if they don't do it? Something that follows. Huh? Lose his car. Why? So my kid goes, why? That's not fair. So what are you going to, what's the rational? Why did it follow? You've abused it, right? I gave you the privilege and the responsibility, key words for our adolescent, of driving and going out, and you came back late. Therefore, I'm taking that away from you.
Sabbath,
you're not going to rest. Okay. So now we have something. So my kid says, right? Well, wait a minute. This was one time, and it's all, why am I not, I have to drive to school, and what is this? I drove safely, I only took one person in the car, so I came back late. So you're not going to let me drive to school, you're not going to let me go out on, you know, Wednesday evening? You could argue yes, right? Or you could say, well, wait a minute, that's actually an interesting point. And this is where you're listening to your teenager. What you did was, you went out late at night, and you came back after the curfew. Next time, whether it's Saturday night, you could, now, okay, next time, whether it's Saturday night, whether it's the next time that they ask to go out with friends, you could say to them, the next time you will not be able to go out. Because you, again, the reasoning is the same, but now you've sort of listened to them. You're not going to make it this broad sweeping, you're going to make it very specific. Everybody has a different style, and I'm not asking you to either take that choice or that choice. The idea here is the process that you're going through. You're presenting the demand, you're presenting the consequence that follows, and then you're also listening. And your child comes back at you and you say, okay, well, I'm going to try to make it a little bit more specific. Okay? Yeah. How so? Manipulation. Is there some manipulation that's, is there a potential manipulation in the back and forth? And yes, that's why a lot of parents won't go into it. I'm going to be manipulated by my kid, and I'm a sucker for my kid. So I'm going to give in. Right? So where do you see the potential? They're brilliant. What happens if the kids say, you say, the next time that you ask to go out, I'm not letting you go out. So hold on. So what's going to happen? So Monday night, the kid's going to not really want to go out, but it's going to say, hey, I want to go out. You say no, and they're, all right, done. Now I'm going out. Yes? Yuffie. Good. And that's why you need to set this out ahead of time. You need to be thinking about this before. The kid gets the license. The first time they want to go out on a Saturday night, you sit down with them and have this conversation. Now, the key, remember, is that A, you must discuss this with your spouse and come to a conclusion before you even sit down with them. You have to be in agreement. So you've worked it out in your head before you sit down with them. And then you're going to have this discussion with them. And so you now, as a parent, say to yourself or say to the child, well, wait a minute. The kid says, well, no, what about if just the next time that I ask you I can't go out? You say, well, I'm concerned about that, and I'll tell you why. Right? And you lay it out there. The discussion, it's very difficult to, A, find the time to have these discussions. First, you got to plan it ahead of time. Then you got to have the time to discuss it with your kid and be ready to go in a back and forth. Third, we're worried about manipulation by our child and really getting into this back and forth, and maybe my kid's going to catch me on something. Those are all things that make us as parents shy away from doing this. The key here is that if you are prepared and if you are open with your child, then overall what you're going to get is a lot more buy-in. If you have an opportunity to say, you know what? I know what my consequences are. I've thought about rational consequences. But I'm going to let my child come up with a couple and see if we can talk it out that way. Then you're encouraging empowerment and buy-in by the kid. Okay? So we're looking for the more opportunities you have to be open and have a discussion with your child, the better your chances that they're going to buy into it. Okay? So what we have, if we look at number one, is we have decided ahead of time that the curfew is at this time. We're telling our child, this is what's expected of you. And we're going to say before it happens, if you get back, then we're in great shape and I can't wait for you to go out next Saturday night. If you miss it, then this is what's going to happen. Your child can say, well, wait, do I get a little leeway for 15 minutes here or there? How great to be able to say yes. Right? So, yeah, I'll give you 10 minutes. Right? Because I'm a reasonable parent. I was a teenager once. Right? So that's great. The more open you can be, that's wonderful. But you're going to all have it developed ahead of time. Okay. If you didn't develop it ahead of time, well, number one, you're asking for trouble. But it doesn't always allow, you don't always have time, right? Your child does something unexpected. You didn't realize, you didn't cover this one when you were thinking about it. What happens when my child says, you know, the kid gets an F on a report that they have for school. You say, why didn't you do it? You know, you're supposed to do your homework every night. Well, you didn't ask me to do it. Or, you know, I did it. You told me to do it, so I did my homework. Now, I didn't tell you that I did it while I was listening to the radio and sort of scribbled it by hand instead of the computer. Well, you know what? I didn't think about that when I was setting my rules for homework at night. So what am I supposed to do? Yeah? Beautiful. It's okay to tell your child, you know what? I'm not sure what to do. I don't have the answer right now. I'm going to have to think about this. You can do that when something unexpected happens, and you can do it in the midst of one of these discussions. You're setting out your rules for the child, and they come back with something you didn't think about. You say, you know, you brought up a good point. I need to sleep on it. One of the most powerful things that a parent can do for a child is to admit that either they were wrong or that they didn't think about it. If you can say, if your child comes up, you put a punishment in there, you put a consequence in there, and your child comes up with something and you're thinking about it and you realize, you know what? That's a good point. It really wasn't fair. If you as a parent can come back the next day and say, I gave it some thought. You know what? What you said is right. It wasn't really fair. So therefore, here's what we're going to do. First of all, your kid's not going to know what to do with you. They listen to me. You're also, in answering that question about what to do with them if they're in school and they're in more of an authoritarian environment, kids are extremely adaptable. And ideally, we want follow-through from school to home. However, what kids learn to do, and what's going to happen is, they're going to learn that home environment is a very safe place. They're going to learn to have a lot more respect for you as parents than they do to their teachers that say, sit down and be quiet and don't ask questions. Or, I spelled it wrong, I didn't spell it wrong, you're wrong, right? That teacher who refuses to admit that they spelled the word wrong, right? They learn to differentiate. And what you're going to get is a lot more respect from your child. Yes?
Okay. I don't like your answer when I have to be home at 2. 15 minutes next week is 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. Then it's 30 minutes. My daughter was due home at 2 minutes last night, 2:33. I'm walking around. Where are you? Ready for the FBI. Doesn't call, pick up the cell phone. What's the matter with you? You're so neurotic. No one else has a curfew. And then I said, I have to go to sleep. I have a lot of
tomorrow.
So I gotta deal with the ring.
Right.
But this is a chronic.
Yeah.
She just got a license. Sadly, she passed the road.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
Okay.
So, if they, if, one second, if it was, it depends on what you've, it depends on what you've set down. It depends on what you've set down as your consequence. Depends on what you've set down. If you've said the rule is 2 o'clock and there is no leeway, then there is no leeway. If you've decided that the rule is 2 o'clock and 15 minutes, then you've said 2 o'clock and 15 minutes. But next week is not 30 minutes because the rule, what's the rule? The rule is 2 o'clock and I have a little leeway because I understand, you know, the red light hits you, you know, on your way back. Doesn't mean that you have to give them the 15 minutes. I'm not advocating for that. There are some teachers, for instance, who say everybody is allowed to miss a homework. Why? Because you know what? Everybody has a time during the semester, during the year, where things just get a little bit too much. And I understand that it happened to me as a teacher, as a student, so I'm going to let you have it. Some teachers say no. The expectation is that you have your homework in. Now, if you're late with your homework, you could still give it in. I'll give you a little grade less, but I'm going to let you hand it in. Doesn't mean that one is better than the other. As long as you can defend your reason, defend your behavior, your target behavior, with a rational reason and consequence, then you're good. And that's fair. And I can't deal with this now. I got to go to sleep. I got a luncheon tomorrow. Great. So then you talk to them tomorrow about it, though. Absolutely. Okay. Yeah.
Late at night and getting to come out home in the morning stuff and be more confused.
And what I would say, that's a specific piece of it, but what I would say is that you can be highly demanding of your child. Okay? Having lots of strict rules is fine. Everybody's going to sort of work that within their family based on their own personality. There is individualizing here. You can have more rules or you can have fewer rules. That's up to you and depends on how your child is, the temperament of your child, right? What kind of personality they are. Do they need lots of structure along the way or do they come make it for themselves? The piece that I'm advocating here and the key to all of this is that whatever rules you have are rationally developed and defended to your child. Because when it makes sense to them, they're buying in. Now we have a couple more minutes. So there's two things I want to do. Number one, I'm going to take more. Remember this piece, okay? Right? This is what I want you to take away because this is a checklist you can go through in your head. What's your target behavior? Are you, as parents, in agreement to the child about what the behavior is? What's the rational consequence to the behavior? And have I covered the oh no's that the kid's going to bring up? Now remember, if the kid comes up with one that you haven't covered, it's okay. Because you're open to having that discussion with them. So that's your checklist. But the overarching principle here is thinking it through and not being impulsive, right? Willing to have a discussion later. And I guess what I didn't say here and which I would also want to stress is consistency. You got to do what you say you're going to do. Okay? Even if it feels harsh at the time, you've got to follow through. Or the kids will add 15 minutes each time. We have a couple minutes. Yes. Yeah. Okay. Yes. Good. We have a couple more minutes, so just... Yeah. I think I would agree. I would say, firstly, yes, as you get older, you want to be able to have more of a discussion than with the younger children. There's no question. I'm not saying it's a uniform thing, 12 to 20, here's what you're doing. I don't want anybody to take those as sort of concrete lines. However, you want to also listen to what your child is saying. The more they start responding and arguing with you, the more you want to be prepared to discuss with them. If they're still at a younger, more immature age where they're willing to sort of accept what you say and trust that my parents have good reason, then don't go into the conversation necessarily. But what you want to model for them is that you're willing to have the conversation when necessary. Okay? Yes?
How do you solve situations, too, when it's not a little child, when it's, you know, like 15 to 20 and doing it?
Situation 2 essentially says your kid keeps, you have to fight with them to get them to the bus in time, and in fact, in the morning to school, they miss the bus, and you end up schlepping them to school more days than you don't. What's your behavior? Your target behavior is that they're ready to walk out the door at whatever time they need to walk out the door. The consequence, does your child get an allowance? If your child, and this only works for a family that gets an allowance, if your child gets an allowance, I'm going to call a cab for you on the days that you miss the bus, and you will pay for the cab out of your allowance. And you won't have it to do what you want to do. Why does that make sense? It's a rational consequence because I have to be somewhere at a certain time. I can't take you to school because it takes away my money. So therefore, it takes away our earning. Either you'll pay me to take you to make up for the money that I'm missing, or I got to go to work, I'm going to call you a cab, and you'll pay for the cab. It rationally follows the behavior. Now, that's one example. You come up with any number of things that you want to do with this child. All right. My watch now says 10:40 or 11:40. If you want to come up here and discuss with me, I'm happy to have a talk. I have my cards up here in case anybody wants to follow up with a phone conversation. Please come up. Thank you very much.
Would you read this to a teenager?
Would I read what to a teenager? Uh-oh, I hope I brought enough of these. This is my theme for the day, as I'm running at it. Okay, thank you. Last one. Exactly. Well, exactly. But I do want to have a constitution. You do want a democracy because these kids are no longer about following blindly. The adolescents want to be a part of this. And as they... Yes, you do. Absolutely. So you set up... All right, I have some cards. These are secondary cards, but you can get in touch with me from there, too. One for you. One for you. Uh-oh, I'm down to my last one. I'm sorry. I'll put my name. I'll tell you in just one second. My private practice is in Teaneck, but I might be opening one in the city as well soon. In Manhattan. Thank you. You can have... No, these papers all have my notes all over them. This is the scenarios, if you'd like them.
What would you say for the client that...
My fact in Teaneck, New Jersey.
Good relationship with them, I try to be positive. And like you said, there's 7 kids on the ground. None of the parents married, but you mind. And come, I'm not the only one. Are you being, you know, and you give it to you all in one time. So what are you doing this kid? Are you really being protective? Are you being really underestimating him?
Part of being authoritative is listening to the child.
Right.
So if the child says, all of my friends get to stay out till 10:30 and don't have to stay out till 10, right? They get that extra half hour. So you have to decide what your values are. You are allowed to have your family values and your rules in your house. And you're allowed to say, that's how that parent does it, and this is how we do it. But I'm going to explain to you why we do it this way. I'm not going to disparage the other parents. I'm not going to talk about the other child. Okay. The piece that I didn't get to here. The piece that I didn't get to, because we could spend a half day seminar on this. The other piece that I didn't get to is allowing your child to choose. In other words, you want to stop at this point. As we said, you don't want to just sort of throw it all at them. You want them to choose. So in other words, and it almost sounds like semantics, but this is how I present it to children all the time. The bus. Right? You've got your choice. You can be up on time. If not, you must be up on time, and I'm going to drag you out of bed, and I'm going to get you on that bus, because you've taken away your adolescent's ability to choose. You're not giving them a choice. You're trying to teach them in the outside world, and they're bigger than you, and they're getting big, right? I say to them, let's say it's not a bus thing. Let's say I have to go to work, and I take you to school, right?
And you're late every single day.
I am in my car at 7:30. Okay? Now this works, again, it works better if it's one of them is out of the house and the other one is still in the house. You have to figure out how it works. But in one typical scenario, I'm out of the house, I'm in my car at 7:30 in the morning to take you. If you are not in the car by 7:35, you are now making a choice. You can be in the car at 7:35 and I'm going to take you and that's going to be great. You can choose to be late. If you choose, that's your choice. I would like you not to make that choice. If you do, then we have the taxi scenario.
Or walk.
It's great. If you're in walking distance,
yeah, but
it's wonderful. Now, if you have a child, now your child, okay, so now, remember, we have to plan. We have to plan, right? So my child says, fine, I won't be up. I won't go to school. I'll stay at school. I'll stay at home. Okay? So now you've got to, ahead of time, you've come up with what's going to happen. This is your oh-no part, right? What happens when my kid says, I don't want to go to school? Okay? So you must be at school. And if you are not at school fulfilling your obligations as a student, then you will not be able to do A, B, or C, which you see as your right as a child also, or as an adolescent, or as a person. In other words, as an adolescent student, you have certain obligations. You have certain responsibilities. You also have privileges that I give you. Now, if you can't fulfill, this is the rational piece. You got to figure out exactly the specifics that work for you. If you can't fulfill your expectations and responsibilities as an adolescent, then you will not get to have the privileges that you expect as an adolescent.
You could take away that cell phone.
The cell phone is one.
Every day, 9:30, I go to school half an hour late because they're not ready when you leave. Okay?
Okay.
So it reaches a point that you're coming to school every day and you're doing that for 6 months now.
Right.
Now it's reaching a point that your other child gets to school late.
Right.
You say, if you're not ready at 8:30 when I leave, I will get you to school at 9.
Right.
And if you're not ready, then I'm leaving.
Okay.
So now it's leaving. And for the last week, you're getting to school at 9:30. School called up on Thursday. and ask the teacher and says, you're going to get 50 points off on every single one of your marks.
Mm-hmm. What about the going after the offense?
I'm sorry? Okay, that's where, in other words, taking away the cell phone won't work, right? In other words, you're being late to school, or you're choosing not to go to school doesn't take away. But it...
What other consequences would there be for the 16-year-old child?
No,
but
right.
And she'll even answer me, if you take away my cell phone, then when I don't go to school, you won't know where I am. So that's what...
But the question is that it happens. In other words, you can't take away that cell phone, but you can't take away that cell phone.
I don't care. That's a threat.